1062, United States versus Cecil Turner. Mr. Gulbranson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lars Gulbranson, and I represent the defendant, appellant Cecil Turner. Mr. Turner was convicted of four counts of violating federal wire fraud statutes under 18 U.S.C. sections 1343, 1346, and section 2, for aiding and abetting the scheme of three janitors who pled guilty to wire fraud charges. Turner was also convicted of two counts of making false statements under 18 U.S.C. section 1001. Very briefly, the underlying scheme that gave rise to this case and Turner's conviction was the failure of three janitors who worked for the Department of Physical Services for the Secretary of State of Illinois to work as many hours as they were required to work, and their deception of their supervisors in creating the impression with their supervisors that they were actually at work when they were not. Turner was the director of physical services and supervised the janitors, albeit distantly. He was several levels above the janitors and didn't directly supervise them. The government's theory in the case was that Turner hindered the investigation into the janitor's failure to work the required hours, and that therefore he was part of the scheme. Turner appeals his conviction and requests that this court overturn his conviction in its entirety because the direct deposits of two of the janitors is not sufficient to meet the furtherance requirement under the wire fraud statutes, either 18 U.S.C. section 1343 or 18 U.S.C. section 1346. Also, contrary to the government's theory at trial, Turner received no private gain as a result in support of their allegation that he deprived the state of Illinois of his honest services. And also because any misstatements Turner made to investigators were not material to their investigation of whether the janitors were working the number of hours they were supposed to work. And first I'll address the furtherance argument. One element of the wire fraud statutes is that a defendant causes a wire, and the government has to prove that the defendant causes a wire transmission in furtherance of the fraudulent scheme. The only evidence that the government presented of this furtherance element was that two of the janitors, Janitor Denora and Janitor Boyce, received their paychecks by direct deposit. The fact that these two janitors received their paychecks by direct deposit was not enough of a connection to the janitor's scheme to meet the furtherance requirement. There's no question that the janitors committed misconduct in performing their job duties, and there's also no question that they were too often absent from work and tried to cover that up. But then the question here regarding this furtherance requirement is whether the manner in which they received their paychecks was sufficiently related to their failure to work and their covering up that failure to work to be in furtherance of the conduct. And the answer to that question is it was not sufficiently related. This court cited the Supreme Court in the Schmuck case for the reason proposition that the federal mail fraud statute and the mail fraud statute and the wire fraud statutes are interpreted under the same case law. The federal mail fraud statute does not purport to reach all frauds. The government's theory in this case that the failure to work and deception in the workplace suddenly becomes wire fraud because you receive your paycheck through direct deposit goes against that statement because it renders any workplace misconduct wire fraud. And this is a greatly enlarged scope of the wire fraud and mail fraud statutes, and this is exactly what this court in the, I'm going to pronounce it quiet, K-W-I-A-T. I'm not sure if anybody has a better pronunciation. But in that case, that's exactly what this court warned against. The wire fraud statutes were not designed to police workplace misconduct. And that's exactly what the government's theory has those statutes doing here. Also, like the Quiet case, the transfers in this case cannot be said to have furthered the janitor's scheme because not all of the co-conspirators even received their paychecks through direct deposit. Only two of them did. That goes to show that the manner of payment, the manner of deposit of their paychecks, had nothing to do with the janitor's scheme to avoid working all these hours. I think also significant in this fact to this argument is how long these janitors had actually worked for the Secretary of State's office and had received paychecks from them. It's not as if they came in and lied and schemed to get their jobs. They had their jobs, and over time, they abused their positions. But the manner of receiving the paychecks had nothing to do with their scheme. Even if the scheme had not existed, even if these janitors had been at work every hour that they should have been at work, they would still have received their paychecks the same way they did. And that was a significant factor in the Quiet case. There's also no evidence presented at trial that the decision by Denora and Boyce to receive their paychecks by direct deposit was temporally related to the scheme. I don't think there was any evidence at trial presented as to when Denora and Boyce said to the Secretary of State's office, "We desire to receive our paychecks by direct deposit." And Denora, the only evidence I think was Denora's testimony, in which he testified that he was already receiving his paycheck by direct deposit in 1999, which is when Turner assumed his role as director, and when the government alleges the scheme began. The direct deposits could not have been in furtherance of the scheme if the decision to receive their paychecks by direct deposit occurred before the scheme began. That just doesn't make any sense. The second argument is that there's no evidence that Turner received any private gain from his alleged role in this scheme. And I think the government comes pretty close to conceding this point. Under the Thompson case, Turner cannot be guilty of depriving the state of his honest services under 18 U.S.C. section 1346 unless he receives private gain. This is problematic here and should result in counts 1 through 4 being overturned because at trial, the government argued that Turner's private gain was receiving favorable trash pickup by the City of Springfield Department of Public Works where Janitor Denora worked. Yet the evidence at trial was that the city gave Turner's family favorable treatment because of their position in the community, not because of any relationship with Denora. There was also evidence that Turner received this favorable treatment even before Turner went to work for the Department of Physical Services. Moreover, under Thompson, I think it's questionable whether favorable refuse pickup or favorable treatment in the pickup of debris and trash from an alley can be considered the type of private gain that would meet the private gain element under Section 1346. I don't think it would under the language of the Thompson case. The government argues that even if there wasn't evidence of this private gain and concedes that then therefore under Thompson and Bloom, the conviction under 18 U.S.C. 1346 was incorrect. The jury could still have correctly found Turner aided and abetted the janitors in depriving the state of tangible property, and that tangible property that they argue the jury could have found is the janitor's paychecks. This argument ignores the fact that the jury instructions under both the straight wire fraud charge and the deprivation of honest services charge allowed the jury to reach a guilty verdict for Turner if it found that he deprived the state of his honest services, which I think under Thompson and Bloom, he could not have deprived the state of honest services without receiving some private gain. The government's argument is also problematic because it blurs the distinction between honest services fraud and tangible property fraud. The government offers no support for the argument that failing to fully perform job functions and yet still receiving a paycheck is tangible property fraud under 18 U.S.C. Section 1343. If it were, there would be no reason for 18 U.S.C. Section 1346. Everybody pretty much works for a paycheck. And if the idea is that in depriving the state or your employer of your honest services, you are not only committing, you're not only depriving your honest service, the honest services, but you're also committing tangible property fraud, those two are blended together and the distinctions in the law become meaningless. And the other problem with that argument is, again, we get into the position where suddenly the wire fraud statute reaches any workplace misconduct. Finally, the court should overturn Turner's conviction of making false statements under 18 U.S.C. Section 1001 because the misstatements were not material. The government's argument that the statements were actually material focuses on the government's investigation of whether Turner was making any misstatements. The agents conducting the investigation told Turner that they were investigating the janitors working and whether the janitors were at work. So this situation becomes a catch-22 because the point of the interview is to see if Turner will make any misstatements. If that's the point of the interview, any misstatement, no matter how innocuous, such as incorrectly stating a date that he learned of a fact or misunderstanding an undefined term such as reprimand, these misstatements suddenly become material because the point of the investigation is to see if he will make a misstatement. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are any questions.
Mr. Chesley.
May it please the court, counsel. This court can be assured that the defendant was convicted on valid grounds for each of the counts of conviction. I'm going to address the honest services issue because I believe that is really the only significant issue in this particular case.
Oh, before you get to that, where is the end if a direct deposit is sufficient to trigger liability under a federal wiretap or a wire fraud charge?
Where's the end? The end is when the scheme comes to fruition.
No. He means what doesn't fall within that. I always had the impression when I was U.S. attorney that if we indicted somebody and mailed them a copy of the indictment, we could allege that was part of the thing that brought us into the wire fraud or use of mails.
There must
be something less than that.
I know the court is trying to set limits and find out what the limits are, but in this case, we're not close to a limit. What we're at here is a situation where the whole object of the fraud was to get money, and the way they did.
They weren't going to get money until these janitors. Now, the janitors, okay, they had a scheme going, a scam, and they were cutting their hours and all that sort of stuff. But I have a problem with what Turner did here. I just don't see it personally. Where's the end? I mean, if in this day and age, almost everybody
is the end.
Gets a direct deposit of their paycheck.
Well, are you talking of whether the mailing is in furtherance, or are you talking about
whether the wire was used to further this? And counts 1 through 4, this conspiracy.
In this case, it was, because that is how two of these janitors got their money. The fact that the other two didn't get their money, the other one and Mr. Turner didn't get their money that way, is not of significance. You can get the proceeds of the fraud in many different ways. Not every mailing has to be a mailing in furtherance of the scheme. Not every money that you get has to come from the mailing in the scheme.
But you still, counsel, haven't answered the question about the limits of the wire and mail fraud statutes if these wire fraud convictions are permitted to stand. Because if they are permitted to stand, then any time any one of the millions of employees of public and private agencies and organizations in this country that receives a paycheck by direct deposit and commits some sort of dishonest or fraudulent act in the scope of employment has committed a federal felony. And that can't be the case. That cannot be the reach of the federal mail and wire fraud statutes.
The mailing has to be in furtherance of the scheme. If it's just something that's not related to it,
That's what we have here. They incidentally happen to get their paychecks, two of the four, by direct deposit. It didn't have anything to do with the scheme here. It's not as though they were using the wires or the mails to submit their fraudulent timesheets, for example.
The mailing,
that would be in furtherance of the scheme. That's not what happened here.
The wire in this case, the wire or the mailing doesn't have to be fraudulent.
I understand that. That's not what we're talking about.
It has to be in furtherance of. That's Judge Sykes' question. Where is it in furtherance?
This is in furtherance because it gives them the money. To get back to your question as to the scheme.
That's just stating
the
obvious.
Scheme,
you know, everybody who gets direct deposit paychecks, that's how they get their money. I mean, that's just stating the obvious. That's not part of this fraud.
Well, if you have a scheme to defraud and the...
And the way you get paid is through the mail or through wire, then that's sufficient for a jurisdictional hook for the federal government.
I believe it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
So if you're an employee of the city of Springfield and you call in sick one day when you're not really sick, you just didn't feel like going to work, and you get your pay at the end of the week but through a direct deposit, you've committed federal violation of federal law. That's the offshoot of your argument. You have to say yes to that.
It is. That would be fraud, but it's not something that the government is...
It's not going to excite the government, you mean.
Pardon me?
It's not going to excite the government.
No, Your Honor. This is a case where you had an egregious fraud, a fraud that went on for 6 years.
Well, the state government can prosecute that, can't it?
The state could, but it comes within... this is a fraud whereby the federal government... The jurisdictional element was met.
Only by stretching it beyond its limits.
If there is a fraud to do, a scheme to defraud, and a mailing in furtherance, the mailing doesn't have to be fraudulent. It can be incidental. And an important part of this particular scheme was that the defendants get their money. Now, the defendants... got their money. The mailing was foreseeable to Turner. He was the one who had to, when he started work...
There was no mailing to Turner.
I'm sorry, wire. Turner had the option of getting direct deposit. He had a conversation with Ruth Ann Vincent a couple years into this scheme where he was suggested, he knew that people could get direct deposit. He had to certify the voucher and the payroll certification that these people would get all their pay. And on that certification, it indicates that these employees get paid by direct deposit. So the evidence is there to show that he knew that these particular employees were going to, the two janitors were going to get paid by direct deposit. He certified that they were working all their hours when they weren't. That's a scheme to defraud and get those janitors their money by wiring them their pay from direct deposit.
While you're at it, you tell me what Turner got out of this thing. I don't see it.
What Turner got out of this thing?
But if you're going to put your job and your career in jeopardy, usually you'd expect something in return for that.
Well,
what did he get here?
The personal gain he got was he got trash and other things removed from his house and didn't
have to
pay for it. But I think Judge McDade, in the sentencing hearing, hit the nail on the head. Mr. Turner had a position in the community in Springfield. He wanted to maintain that position. He wanted to be, I think, what Judge McDade called the man. He wanted to people in his community to know that he could get things done, and that if there was a problem there, if there was cleanup, he was the guy that was going to be able to do it.
That doesn't cut it under Thompson and Bloom. There needs to be some tangible private gain.
I understand that, but the private tangible gain is the fact that he didn't have to pay to have this stuff hauled away. I mean, we're talking about a half a tandem truckload of campaign signs when there were elections.
I thought all the testimony was that he got that special treatment because his wife was on the county board.
No, that's wrong. He got special treatment because he and Denora had a tacit agreement that Denora would do these things. He got treatment that no one else got.
Well, he was getting it before this scheme, right?
I don't know that there's any evidence that actually says that he got it before the scheme. I would like to see a page citation for that, but I don't remember that happened. But even if he did, the thing that Denora was providing for Turner was he was providing him expedited service. He was getting same day or next day service. The other politicians, the other people didn't get that.
So if Mayor Daley is getting his street plowed faster than any other people, or getting his trash picked up every Monday, a lot of people might have to wait a little longer. That's some sort of fraud or something. Huh?
Depends on what he's doing for the people picking up the garbage.
Well,
I think we ought to stay with Milwaukee, though, for this
one.
Judge Bauer gets well taken care of.
In addition, to answer Judge Sykes' question, in addition,
they do pick up my garbage regularly.
The frequency that Denora was doing it for Turner was much more than it was being done. It was once or twice a week. It wasn't done nearly to that frequency. And also, Denora testified that they picked up things that the city wouldn't normally pick up for Turner. No one testified that the city would pick up those things. There was testimony that the city would pick up things, but they were never particularly identified for these other politicians. So Turner was treated differently. Turner did get more than other politicians in Springfield. The issue of the honest services. Well, let me just address the mailing, because that, the court seems to be hung up on.
There was no mailing.
I mean, the wire. The case cited by the defendant, the Quiet case, is substantially different from this case. In the Quiet case, the bank directors had a scheme to defraud. They got commissions every time the bank financed a condominium, a $15,000 commission. For that case to be like our case, if that $15,000 commission was mailed to the defendants, that would be the same type of mailing here. The proceeds, what the defendants were after was money. The scheme wasn't, as the defendant defined it, just a scheme to play hooky from work. It was to get their pay without working at all. And for the last 2 years, Denora was basically a ghost payroll. And the only reason these janitors could have done that was with Turner's help. The scheme could not have succeeded without Turner's help. The scheme was to get money, and that's precisely what the indictment alleges. In paragraph 14, the janitors devise a scheme to receive their full pay without working full time. That's what paragraph 14 of the indictment says. The scheme wasn't completed until the janitors were paid. In quiet, the scheme was completed when they got their $15,000. What happened with the mortgages afterward had nothing to do with this scheme. Here, the wiring of the paychecks has everything to do with the scheme. And in any circumstance when people are defrauding the state out of their money, when they're ghost payrollers like Denora was, that's a scheme to defraud. And the way they get their proceeds of the fraud, the object of the fraud is completed by the wiring, in this case, of the paychecks for two of the janitors. With respect to the honest services, the indictment alleged both types of wire fraud, property fraud and honest services fraud. And the government will concede that the decision in Thompson, which was decided after this defendant's conviction, makes it a close call. We don't concede that there is no private gain, but we think the private gain issue can really be put aside and the case can be decided on another basis. A reasonable jury may be able to find private gain, but in this case what we have is the jury was instructed it could find in the elements instruction either defendant guilty of the property fraud or the honest services fraud. The jury returned a general verdict. Supreme Court in Griffin indicated that if one of the bases for conviction lacks adequate factual support, that's not a basis for reversal. The jury was properly instructed in this case. The defendant doesn't argue otherwise.
Time has expired. Anything further?
I just briefly want to respond to some of what counsel said. First of all, on the honest services, counsel asked for a citation to the record where it was said that that Turner received these trash pickup services before the alleged scheme began, and the site in the transcript is Denora's deposition testimony at pages 285 to 286.
There's a deposition part of the record of the trial.
Oh, sorry. Did I say deposition? I meant Turner's or Denora's testimony at trial.
Good. Carry on.
In the transcript, pages 285.
I had one of my sinking spells. I think. Changed all the rules.
No. Yeah. No. And in that part of the transcript, Denora testified that in the 90s, when he had a different boss, Jim Reinhardt at the streets department, he also went and was ordered to go pick up refuse at Turner's residence. And a lot of this refuse wasn't really in Turner's residence. It was in a back alley and in the neighborhood in which Turner lived. And the evidence was Turner was a community leader. He took care of his community. That's why he was calling the street department to come pick up trash in this neighborhood. I want to briefly address counsel's argument regarding the foreseeability issue and whether Turner knew that these wire frauds, that these transfers could have been made by direct deposit. And I think that argument throws us off course. That's different than the furtherance argument. The idea of foreseeability and cause has nothing to do with whether the transfers were actually in furtherance of the alleged scheme. So whether or not Turner could have found out that Denora and Boyce were receiving their paychecks by direct deposit is not relevant to the question of whether the transfers were actually in furtherance of the scheme. And finally, I will briefly address the argument regarding Griffin and the line Griffin is that if the jury convicts on an inadequate ground, an inadequate factual ground, if they fail to find all the all the facts sufficient to meet an element. That's not the same as failing to convict or convict where the court can't figure out whether they convict on an invalid legal ground. And my argument is that I think that the honest services argument rises to the level of an improper legal ground, because the argument at trial by the
government. What happened to the three janitors, by the way?
They pled guilty. They were sentenced, and I'm not exactly sure what their sentences actually were.
Maybe your opponent can enlighten us.
Denora went to jail for, I believe, approximately 5 or 6 months. The other two janitors were sentenced to probation.
Thank you.
So I think, as far as Griffin, I think we still have a problem here in not knowing whether the jury convicted on an invalid legal ground for honest services. Thank you.
Thank you. You were appointed in this case. Thanks to you and your firm, Mr. Gonering, for accepting the appointment.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, proceed now to the